Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Nonprofit U. We're a forum where nonprofit stakeholders can share lessons learned and discuss the latest developments in the industry. My name is Valerie Leonard, and I'm your host. I'm a consultant to nonprofits, and I specialize in community and organizational development. I work with nonprofit organizations to help them make a stronger impact to their clients as well as to their communities. And you can find Nonprofit U on Facebook and Twitter. I encourage you to comment early and often. And today we're using the hashtags Nonprofit U, Government Grants, and Proposal Writing. You can also leave comments on blogtalkradio.com/nonprofit_U. And the chat room is open. You can post comments and questions. And in order to use the chat room, you have to open a listener-only account, and you can find a link to open that account on the episode page. And you can also email me questions at consulting@valeriefleonard.com or send messages through Facebook and Twitter. You'll find the Nonprofit U fan page on Facebook, and the Twitter account is @NonprofitU. And we'll be taking questions by phone and from our chat room at about the 20-minute mark. The call-in number is 347-884-8121. Again, that number is 884-8121. I don't have a studio guest today, but I think you'll be really interested in this topic. We're going to be talking about in the public domain, and we will be discussing public grants and looking at strategies as to how to effectively write and submit public grants. So these can be grants at the state level, these can be grants at the federal level or the county level. You know, the information, I think, you know, is readily transferable to all three situations. And we encourage you to call in with questions and participate in live chats at about the 20-minute mark. But if you're chatting, you can actually start now. We just won't raise your questions until about the 20-minute mark. And again, the call-in number is 347-884-8121. And nonprofit professionals, educators, and community stakeholders are especially encouraged to call in, share some of your questions, your concerns, your war stories, and your triumphs. We're all here to learn from one another. So again, today's topic is in the public domain, and we'll be discussing how to write effective proposals. And we've got a lot of ground to cover here. We may end up going over just a little bit. I'm going to try to get as much done as we can in the half hour. We're going to look at what a proposal is. We're going to look at strategic planning for proposal development. We'll be looking at program planning as it relates to proposal development. Preparation, developing ideas, community support, finding resources, and then we'll actually talk about writing the proposal, and then we'll be talking about contract/grant administration, and then compliance, because really the work begins really after you get the grant. So we want to show you how to maintain compliance and keep those dollars. So what we want to do now, we want to step back just a little bit and share with you what's new in the realm of federal and state proposal writing. What we find here in the state of Illinois is now, I guess for the third year, maybe fourth year or so, they are implementing budgeting for success, whereby they look at some of their major agencies that get funding and looking at their performance, and they will use those performance benchmarks to determine whether or not their, you know, certain programs are eligible for future funding. And those agencies that actually give out grants and make contracts, they're also holding their grantees and contractors accountable to those same performance benchmarks. So it's going to be a much more rigorous system here in the state of Illinois. And then you're all too familiar with grants.gov, you know, where there's a central repository of every federal grant. So if you want to look on grants.gov, you can find every agency that is providing grant funding. Well, the state of Illinois is going to be doing something similar. They hope to implement it, I think, by next year, probably the middle of the year. But they're going through a process now where they're putting in systems for performance management. Again, that's going to be even more rigorous than we've seen before. And they will have a central repository where there will be a common grant application. There will be common performance management measures that will be applied across the board regardless of what agency. So they're going to be replicating what we see at the federal level. So what that means for us, people who are preparing grants, those of us who are running agencies, we really need to get familiar with the new rules of the game. We really need to familiarize ourselves with the landmark. And you can actually go on my website. I have a link to the government, well, the Illinois state government's page, as well as grants.gov. So you can find out more information about what the budget office at the state of Illinois level is doing with respect to centralizing the grants. And you can also find out more about grants.gov. So I just thought I'd share that first before I talk about what it is we plan to get out of today's discussion. So basically, we want to help you to develop your concept utilizing a program logic model, and we want to help you identify sources for demographic and socioeconomic data and help you to write a compelling needs assessment. After that, we're going to talk about developing realistic goals and objectives and how to design a program using sound methodology. After that, we will look at identifying potential public funding sources and ways to garner community support for your idea. And then we'll close off by talking about developing a program budget and evaluation plan and positioning your organization or your program for long-term sustainability, meaning, you know, how are you going to stick around for the long term once that government grant runs out. So we will look at the definition of a proposal. We'll talk about strategic planning as it relates to preparing your proposal. We'll talk about program planning as it relates to preparing your proposal. And then we'll talk about the preparation. And then we'll talk about developing ideas, garnering support, finding resources, writing the proposal, and contracting grant administration and compliance. So basically, you know, repeating the list that I gave you before. So at this point, we're going to not assume that you know anything. So if this is redundant, if it seems rudimentary or elementary to people, forgive me, I'm just not assuming that anybody knows anything. So basically, a proposal is a written expression of a problem as well as how the organization proposes to address the problem. So typically, most proposals have a needs assessment or a statement of the problem as the basis for the project. And then it's used to make the case for funding and to provide guidance for program development and evaluation. And then we find that funding decisions are largely based upon the organization's ability to carry out its mission. So you have to be able to demonstrate or give the impression that you have the capacity to do what you say you're going to do. You can have a really flowery proposal, but, you know, people who read the proposals are savvy enough to be able to reconcile what it is that you have said in your proposal and what you haven't said with the documentation that you apply or that you support the application with. So, you know, there's more than one way to assess capacity. So when we look at strategic planning as it relates into developing our proposal, the first thing we want to do is assess the needs in our communities. So we want to look at the community as a whole, look at who is actually addressing the issue, and if people are addressing it and you still are able to identify gaps, then, you know, it might make sense to continue down that path. And then you want to propose a solution, and the solution doesn't have to be anything earth-shattering. It just needs to make sense, given what the issues are and what the data are that support what the problem is. So when we speak of data and the type of data we collect, we want to look at statistical data, and one of the most common ways to find data is going on census.gov. We can find census tract data for the area that we're concerned about. So you can look at different geographies. You can look at a single census tract. You can look at a block. You can look at a city. You can look at a county. You can look at a national. You can look at a state. And with the new census.gov, you can actually create your own unique geographies. So that's pretty interesting. Then, you know, so that's one way of getting statistical or quantitative data. Other data that we might look at, you know, depending on where, you know, what area we're focused on, you know, if you're in community development, you might look at things like property values, absorption rates, and average rents and tax rates and all that good stuff. If you're in education, you might be looking at reading scores, school closures and openings and all that good stuff. So clearly the type of statistical data is very largely dependent upon what area you're in. And then you can get spatial data. And spatial data are those data that you can map. So, you know, you can look at maps, you can look at graphs. So and then more and more we're seeing data visualization. So basically it's a graphic or geographic presentation of facts and figures. And then we look at empirical data. So empirical data, those are the things that we can see. So those come from personal observations and experience that we've had, you know, doing the work that we do. It can come from reports we get from our clients. It can come from community surveys and focus groups. So those things that we can directly observe. We can get our data from, you know, obviously, you know, word of mouth. We can get data from reading different scholarly journals, et cetera, et cetera. So basically data is just information. It could be quantitative information. It could be qualitative information. Then when we look at what the data suggests, so when we look empirically, those empirical studies, you know, basically analyzing what it is that we can see, we typically want to use those to determine the types of needs, how severe they are, and who specifically exhibits those needs. So when we're looking at developing a target, empirical studies are pretty good, you know, quick and dirty, right? Then we have spatial studies. And spatial studies are really good for when we want to just get a glance, you know, take in at a glance what the problem is and where it is and where the gaps are. So spatial studies will help us to understand where current and potential clients are as it relates to a certain issue. Spatial studies will tell us the areas of highest concentration of people who need those services and vice versa. And spatial studies can also tell us, you know, over time where these problems are, where they are most highly concentrated. And when we look at census tract data and public records, again, this can tell us who those potential clients are, how many there are, and where they are. And again, you can use the census tract data to drive what your maps actually look like. And then, you know, even beyond the census tract data, you have your economic census. And your economic census can give you information, you know, more detailed information on employment. You can also go to the Department of Labor and find even more detail on employment. You can also look at the economic census to find out where the different businesses are located, the composition of minority workers in those businesses, or who owns those businesses. All of that stuff, you know, is a matter of public record, and it's pretty cool, I think. And then when you also go back to your empirical studies, you can develop questionnaires and surveys, and you can read researchers' reports, and you can conduct those interviews. Again, we're collecting information that's readily observable. And then for spatial studies, you can generate maps by plotting data. So you don't necessarily have to rely just on census tract data. You know, if you were studying schools, you'll get school addresses and plot those. If you were looking at the number of park communities, you would get the locations of those parks. And then, you know, you begin to plot those data, and they tell you a picture immediately of, you know, where your community's assets and resources are. And the good thing about the census tract data is you can download them, and you can actually, you know, manipulate them and tailor the data sets to what it is that you need. Other public records that we look at, we can go to the Chicago Board of Education, we can go to the State Board of Education, and you can see that I'm someone who really, really enjoys school, so I talk about school data a whole lot. But, you know, if you have to study, say, ex-offenders, you can get those data from the State Illinois Department of Corrections. If you need to understand better what's going on at the county level with housing, you know, they have those data as well. So basically the point I'm making is it depends on, you know, what it is that you're studying, who has the jurisdiction over the area that you are studying and you're trying to get money for, right? So when we look at helpful hints, you know, things that I've learned over the years is, you know, don't try to drive the community needs assessment. You know, don't go through a mindset of, you know, we'll build it and they'll come. You know, you have to have an open mind and let the process run its own course. And, you know, go where the data take you and be flexible enough and don't get so wedded to a certain idea where you find that the data don't support it and then you're so bullheaded and you try to build something that ends up being a white elephant. So be very clear. And then you make sure that your organization has the capacity. You know, more and more, the state government as well as the federal government, they're looking at whether or not you can do what it is you say that you can do. And they look they're looking at more than just the proposal. They're looking at supporting documentation that you provide to determine whether or not you can do what it is you say that you can do. And then you want to establish relationships with people at all levels of the grant-making process. You know, so, you know, get to understand the program officer, or, you know, the director of the program who comes and gives technical assistance. If you're applying for a grant at the state level, you know, get the contact information for the person, you know, whose name is printed in the grant application. They might be able to provide you with even more information. And from time to time, they'll do webinars and whatnot. So it's really important to make sure that you understand what level of person can provide what type of information for you at these different agencies and keep in touch with them. And then locally, you want to make sure that you have, first of all, the support for your board from your board members, and you want to make sure that you have the support of community partners. You know, one of the worst things you can do is submit a proposal and then have people calling and, you know, speaking with different people in the community, and they're not getting a favorable report. And, you know, you want to make sure that you get support from your staff, support from clients, support from other agencies and other state and federal agencies. You know, we're finding more and more that the agencies are requiring that you provide, you know, who did you get the grant from, you know, what is their name, phone number, how much was it, how did you perform, and all that good stuff. So it's really, really important to not only maintain relationships, but make sure that you have effectively managed the money that you've gotten already, right? Because the best predictor of what you'll do in the future is what you've done in the past. Now, when we look at letters of support, you know, typically we see people, they might do a letter of support. You know, it's a very generic letter of support saying, you know, I'm from XYZ organization, and I support ABC proposal. You know, that in and of itself, you know, it is nice if you get somebody to do that, but that's really not what they're looking for these days. When they talk about letters of support now, we're probably looking more, we're stopping just short of an MOU, Memorandum of Understanding. They're basically saying that if person, you know, if your agency gets this, not only am I, as you know, a fellow agency supportive of it, these are the different things that I can do. You know, these are the resources I can offer. This is how I can support it. You know, usually it could be a referral relationship. Sometimes there may be some money exchange, some contractual relationship. But they basically want you to be very, very specific and not just say, wow, this is nice, and I support it. And also when you prepare, you know, you want to make sure that you research the issue. You don't want your presentation or your proposal to sound, you know, like everybody else's proposal. You want to show that you have, you know, a different angle on the same information. So when you look at your census statistics, don't just run a generic report. You know, really look at the statistics, try to get behind the numbers and see what those numbers are telling you. And then you want to be able to cross-reference those statistics with people, right? You know, you don't want to bore people to death by just providing numbers, but then at the same time, you don't want to sound too fluffy by just giving them just people. So you want to mix it up, have a good mix of research with quantitative, qualitative data. You want to show that you understand, you know, what the experts are saying. So you want to get expert opinions on the different issues. And you want to be able to quantify the cost of whatever your projects are and, you know, the components of those costs and identify those funding sources. And then, again, you want to establish relationships with key decision makers because, you know, at a certain level, you know, it goes beyond just the writing the proposal. You know, relationships do count. And, you know, if you're one of those agencies that's on the borderline where it can go one way or the other, you know, having those relationships and having people really understand who you are, knowing who you are, so that when they see your paper and it may not be quite right or it may not have all the information. And I'm not saying submit a raggedy proposal, but sometimes we have a tendency to not include all the details of what we need to have. So that's what I'm talking about. So if you're not putting in as many details, they may have a tendency to give you the benefit of the doubt as opposed to someone that they've never seen before and then just make assumptions that you don't know what you're talking about. Okay, so at the end of the day, it's all about people. And then you want to make sure, you know, we all have different levels of capacity, but you want to make sure that whatever you propose is within the capacity that you have. So if you're competing, okay, you're a two-man shop and you're competing with a large institution, don't try to write a proposal that has the same deliverables and the same impact as the institution. You want to be able to talk about what you can do, what you can deliver within the capacity of your two-person shop, if that makes sense. So we're at about the 25-minute mark, and I have quite a few more notes. This obviously is going to go a little bit longer than 2:30. So I'll take a break now. If you have any questions, you can type them in or you can call, and then I will go on. So our call-in number is area code 347-884-8121. Again, that's 884-8121. And if you have any questions in the chat room, you are more than welcome to type those. Okay, so the next thing I'm going to talk about is the program logic model. And I'm going to talk about a very simple one. And all a program logic model is it tells you basically the sequence within which you're going to develop your program. And these are good not only for proposals, but they're good for developing programs. They're good for developing your evaluation process. And ideally, you want to be able to use the same program logic model from the time you actually conceive of the idea to develop the proposal, program development, all the way to evaluation. So you want to be able to use this at all three levels. So the first thing we talk about are the inputs. So the inputs are those resources that we need in order to address the issue. So clearly this comes after you have looked at the whole environment and identified what's necessary and what the issues are. And it also assumes that you have some sort of goal, right? So given what's going on in the environment and given what the goals and objectives are, what are the resources that you need in order to solve that problem? And then the next thing we want to do is look at, you know, basically what will we do? What are the activities that we're going to engage in order to solve that problem? And here's the most important thing. What's going to change? You know, what's going to be our impact as a result of doing this program? And I want to pause here and explain that there is a difference between programs and services. We typically use them interchangeably, but they're very different. A service, we know, benefits the community, and we know a program benefits the community, right? The difference is a service is benefiting the client, but we really don't have any proof, right? There's no intentionality. There are no goals. There are no objectives involved, whereas a program is a set of activities, a set of services that have an intentionality around making a change in an environment, a change to a client. So that's basically the difference. And when you look at examples, you know, we know a soup kitchen and we know a diet, right? A soup kitchen and a diet are both good for the people that use them, right? However, a soup kitchen, we tend to not track what's going on. We don't really care about what they eat. We don't care about how many times they come. We don't look at their weight before and their weight after. We don't look at their strength before and after versus a diet. A diet, you know, you look at, you know, we take a baseline. We look at the weight, right? And then some people do all their measurements. They might measure their waist, their forearms, their thighs, and all that good stuff. And then they might document the exercise, blah, 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 blah. And then at certain intervals, you expect to see some change, assuming that you do what it is you said you would do. So that's the difference. You know, a diet is a program, and a service is a soup kitchen. Okay, so moving right along, When you're preparing your proposal, you want to make sure that you have certain documents. There is a basic list of things that you need. At the top of them would be articles of incorporation, and those should be the articles that have actually been registered with the state of Illinois. You want to have a certificate of good standing from the state, as well as your IRS letter or letter of determination or 501c3 letter. So you want to be able to have all that stuff on file. Most government agencies are going to ask for them. You need to have your most recent audited statements, at least 2 years' worth, and then your most recent monthly financial statements. And this should, at a minimum, be your balance sheet, your income statement, and your cash flow statement. And ideally, your income statement should be written in a way, budget versus actual. You also want to have your annual report ready and your Form 990. And for the state of Illinois, it's your AG 990-IL. So you want to have your federal Form 990 and the state equivalent. And basically, what those forms are, they're not tax returns, but nonprofits will file those instead of tax returns. So those are information returns. You want to have media articles. Some government agencies will request these from time to time, and more and more they're not. They're trying not to have as much paper. You should have resumes and bios for your key people. This would be people on staff as well as your board. So depending on the questions that are asked, sometimes they ask for the bios, sometimes they ask for the resumes, sometimes they just want a very brief description of capabilities. So it all depends. But if you had a resume, you can, and you didn't have any of that other stuff, you can answer any question about your people. If you're doing a development project, you should have architectural drawings. You should have your engineering drawings, that'll talk about the site. You should have letters of support and any other certification. So if you're doing a hospital project, you would need certifications from the state and that the state is okay with it and all that good stuff. And then when you're working with contractors, other types of certifications you might want to see, if you're working with minority or women-owned businesses, so you might want to be able to share that information, share the work plan, and any other certifications that would be required. Some agencies, from time to time, they ask for the letter of intent, and some don't. It all depends on what agency. But basically, a letter of intent is a summary of the proposal. It's not really a proposal. We'll just call it an executive summary. And if they like what they see, then they will invite you to submit a full proposal. So basically, in a nutshell, you're going to talk about things like your organization's history, mission, and goals. You're going to talk about the project. You're going to talk about how it addresses a need, what's going to change as a result of the project, and how you're going to project, and then, the cost of it and all that good stuff. So you want to try to squeeze all of that in one page. Sometimes they'll allow two. It depends on the agency. But then, if they like what they see, they will invite you to write a full proposal. And one of the most important parts of a government proposal is the needs assessment. They want to make sure that they're not pouring money into communities that are oversaturated. So you need to demonstrate that not only is there a need, but your program can actually address that need. And then the need should also have a direct relationship between the organization's mission and purpose. So they're not going to give money to people who are just chasing after dollars, right? They want to make sure that when they give money, that they're actually in the business of doing something similar to what it is they're applying for. And then you want to focus the needs not on your organization, that is, except you're applying for money to actually strengthen your organization. But typically, the needs should be for community as well as your clients. And then you want to make sure that you support your needs statement with documented facts. And then you want to make sure that you demonstrate that you have the capacity to do it. And then another thing that's really important, you know, once you identify the need, you want to talk about your goals and objectives. So given what the needs are in the community, what are your goals? And your goals are basically a broad-based statement of the ultimate result. Okay, so for example, the homebound elderly in Maine County will live with dignity and independence in their own home. So that's the goal. Your objectives talk about how you're going to reach that goal. And you can have outcome objectives and you can have process objectives. An outcome objective is measurable, time-specific, and it basically is going to tell you, you know, what's going to change as a result, right? And then the process quantifies the method for achieving the goal, but it's just talking, you know, operationally. So, for example, an outcome objective, which, again, focuses on what's going to change and when, there's going to be a 5% decrease in the number of frail older adults going into convalescent homes during the first year of the social services referral program. A process objective, right, for the same goal is there's going to be an increase in social service referrals and follow-up for 75% of the individuals served by the MEALS Consortium during the 2000-2001 year. So basically the first one is telling you what's going to change, and then the other one is telling you, you know, the process on, of how they're going to do it. Okay, and then we've got to make sure that the goals and objectives are related to the need statement. So all this stuff builds upon itself. So you start with the needs statement, then the goals and objectives, and all of that stuff needs to be related. And then when we talk about the methods are, you know, the activities that the organization is going to engage in. So, so for example, one way you're going to reduce recidivism, you know, if your overall goal is to reduce recidivism, how do you do that? Well, there's no one thing that you do in order to reduce recidivism. There needs to be several different things or several different methods. One proven key to the mix is making sure that you can do job training. But before you can even engage in job training, you have to help ex-offenders to decompress and begin to become self-aware and change some of those old attitudes and even activities and desires. You also need to make sure that they have mentors so that they can stay on the straight and narrow. So those are three different methods when brought together with actual employment. Those have been proven to actually reduce recidivism. So that brings me to another point. You want to make sure that whatever methods you use, there's data, there's evidence. So this is what we call evidence-based. You want to make sure that there's evidence that this model that you're proposing can work. You have to show that it has worked in other environments or you have used it yourself, and that will give from the government comfort that you have indeed you have the capability to do what it is that you said that you would do. You want to make sure that you include the rationale. You know, why did you choose this method over another method? And usually that method, that rationale is grounded in some research. And speaking of research, now we've come to the evaluation part. Again, you want to make sure that you start your evaluation planning when you do your proposal, you know, ideally. You know, most of us are not in those situations. You know, most of us are kind of brought into an existing program. But if you're fortunate enough to be writing a proposal for a brand new program, the time where you start doing your evaluation planning is when you're actually doing the proposal. And then you use that same evaluation plan, you know, through the implementation as well as evaluation. And it all starts with your program logic model, where you kind of look at what's going on in the environment, have your goals and objectives, look at the activities, look at the resources, look at the outcomes and how you're going to measure them. And you use that as your roadmap and your roadmap in the proposal stage. You use it as your reality check when you're doing the implementation, and then you're using it as your foundation when you're doing the evaluation to say, did we do what we said we would do? And you want to look at quantitative methods as well as qualitative. You know, again, the quantitative methods are those statistical things. You know, we're looking at numbers, and again, you can get a lot of numbers from common places like the Census Bureau, the Department of Labor. And then those are really good to determine cause and effect, look at relationships, you know, among different variables. And ideally, you know, unless you're, you know, in the ivory tower, you're not going to have to get that deep with the numbers, but it really helps to be able to use the numbers to demonstrate the impact. Those qualitative methods are those methods that we use to get behind the numbers. So once we've done a survey where we're counting things and, you know, counting people's responses, you know, X percentage of people said this or whatever, or after we're using those surveys to gauge people's attitudes, you know, you're using numeric data to gauge those attitudes, then you might want to use focus groups so you can get behind those numbers, right? Because you're not going to be able to get all the information that you need in the question on the survey. You know, most people don't have time to do any more than 10 questions. So if you want to get several viewpoints and get behind the numbers, you might want to do a focus group or an interview. And then one of the last things we want to talk about is sustainability. So what happens once the government money runs out? How are you going to keep your program going after it runs out? So the first thing you want to do is take stock of, you know, what you already have in place. You know, look at other players, obviously, you know, other foundations. But more and more people are looking at going into ventures that will help them to sustain the organization. So it might be, you know, a venture where they might open a restaurant. It might be a real estate venture. So things that will throw off cash that won't involve any grant. It's money that will allow organizations, you know, flexibility. You know, they're not necessarily locked into certain terms of a grant. And one of the best ways to do this is to do a business plan or strategic plan, so you're not just, so that you're not just out there, right? You have data that's going to show that your venture is indeed feasible. And then after you do that, the next part of the proposal is the budget. So for everything that you put out there, you know, you identified the need, you looked at the goals and objectives, you looked at the methods and, you know, how you're going to address the problem, you're going to have to be able to reflect that in your budget. So just like you have a program narrative that talks about the issues and the problems and the way you're going to address them with words, your budget is going to be basically a numeric reflection of what's going on. So there should be nothing in that budget that isn't reflected in the narrative, and there should be nothing in that narrative that can't be supported by the budget. You know, the two have to be consistent in order to create a realistic proposal and a realistic budget. And then finally, we want to talk about contract administration. So, you know, once you get the money, again, the real work begins. You know, typically agencies are going to want to keep in touch with you on a monthly basis to do monthly reports, quarterly reports. They may do site visits. And depending on where you are in terms of capacity, if you are deemed a high-risk organization, they're going to be in touch with you a little bit longer. You're going to be under a little bit more scrutiny, which is really not a bad thing. It might make you a little nervous, but sometimes it helps to have that extra hand on you to help you to do things. You know, there may have been things you have missed along the way in developing your program that a state or federal monitor is going to ask, and you may or may not have it at the time, but going through that exercise, it helps you get a better understanding of what is definitely required, you know, what's considered a best practice. But, you know, if you're new to a state or federal grant, just know that the monitoring is going to be more rigorous, you know, because they're, that one, they don't know you, and two, they've already looked at your capacity and have observed that there's some things that you may need to work on. So, I mean, look at it as a blessing in disguise. And then, again, you're going to not only have to do those reports, but, you know, make sure you continue to file the Form 990 and your audited statement and all of that good stuff. And just understand, too, that there are penalties for not complying. You know, if you don't get your 990, you know, you can be penalized for being late. You could have to pay interest as well as penalties. If you're not providing information on a timely basis with the grant, then you could lose the grant, and in some cases, you have to repay the money. So it pays to stay current with those reports. You know, that's why it's so important that you have good records and keep everything in a central file. So we've already gone over, and I really do appreciate your time. Want to let you know that you're listening to Nonprofit You, and we're discussing how to write effective proposals for government grants. If you have any questions, give us a call. We're at 347-884-8121. So we've come to the end of our show, and I'd like to thank you for listening. Tune in next week when we will have Ashley Whalen. She's a communications officer with LISC, and we'll be discussing ways nonprofit leaders can get their message out on a shoestring budget. And I am looking forward to another lively discussion. All right. Until then, take care. Bye-bye.